The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein, thrilled to be with you for another one of our live Clubland Q&As. You know how this works. It's 11 a.m. North American Eastern Time. That's noon in the Canadian Maritimes, half past midday in beautiful Newfoundland and Labrador and beyond the Americas, 4 p.m. in London, Dublin, 5 p.m. Paris and Berlin, 6 p.m. in Istanbul and Jerusalem, 7 p.m. in the Trucial States. We occasionally get a call from the Trucial States, a question from the Trucial States. Last one was from someone who wasn't even aware he was living in the Trucial States until I described them thus. It's 7:30 p.m. in Kabul, where the 87% of the Afghan population who are fully accredited United States translators, almost all of them are now believed to have been evacuated, so the city is deserted. It is 8:45 p.m. in Kathmandu, because if you don't dig the half-hour time zones, you got to move to the 15-minute ones. 10 p.m. in Bangkok, 11 p.m. in Perth, Western Australia. I don't even want to think what hour it is for all our Eastern Aussies and Kiwis and Pacific Islanders, but we hope a few of you are with us right now. It's coming up to Canadian Thanksgiving in a couple of days. I think that's still a thing. I think one can still practice that. It's also Columbus Day, and good luck with that. This is our Clubland Q&A. Anyone can listen, all 7 billion persons on this earth. You have to be a Mark Stein Club member to ask a question. If you don't want to ask a question, no need to join the Mark Stein Club. We seek no unwilling members. We just want people who want to hang around here. George Pereira says, Mark, the latest round of Haitians will be arriving in 20 days. Don't fall for that. There are always Haitians coming across the border. The border is, there is no border. I don't even know why we call it a border. It's a geographical feature. It's an attractive, if somewhat shallow, river, the Rio Grande, and there's no such thing as that anyone throughout human history would recognize as a functioning frontier anymore. But George says, latest round of Haitians will be arriving 20 days. Their motto, and this time, with papers or without papers, we are ready for war. These are the new Americans that he calls him resident asterisk and spits on the ground in disgust. I think that's a reference to Joe Biden. Has the hots for. Am I on bizarro world? How can anyone even think that this is going to end well? My motto, let's go, Brandon. If you're not up on your internet memes, this is some NASCAR race the other day where the NBC commentator, some fella called Brandon, was in the lead, and the NBC commentator assured us that the enthusiastic crowd were shouting, let's go, Brandon, when in fact they were very clearly and audibly shouting, bleep Joe Biden. So, let's go, Brandon, is now the new motto of the resistance, and it's a good one. I like that. Yeah, look, I had a conversation, I think this was with Lara Logan, and I asked her this, and I'll just say this as someone who came back across the Canadian border yesterday, I think it was, and this I asked her about the difference between the Canadian and the US border, because the Canadian border, my little border post, is now Checkpoint Charlie with East Berlin on both sides, basically. It's a nightmare to get across. You've got to have all kinds of paperwork. You've got to have your COVID test results from within 72 hours and getting the express one round here. Everyone's figured that, oh, wait a minute, you know, oh, it's a public health emergency. Yes, I want to be public spirited. So let's all have these COVID tests. The COVID tests, to get the quick turnaround COVID test here near my little border post is $250. So that makes having lunch in Quebec rather expensive. I came back. It's been going on a year and a half now. And I get to the little tiny border post, which actually, you know, I mean, basically a hut. And it's all blocked. It's not blocked off on the American side, but one of the CBP guys comes out and holds his hand up and says, "Oh, no, the border post is closed." And I say, you know, well, where's the next one open? So he sends me to the one that's whatever it is, 10, 15 miles to the east. So I drive off. And as I'm driving off, I'm thinking, I should have been more annoyed with him. Because it's really, why didn't I just do the Haitian thing and just say, coming through? And I felt I should have been. So I resolved to use, which a line I use with officialdom fairly frequently now. I use the old Daffy Duck line, shoot me now. And actually, as I think about it, although it tends to depress them and makes them feel bad, I remember one guy go, "Oh, really? That's how you think of me? I'm going to be a guy who just puts a bullet in you?" It makes them feel bad. But as I think about it, I'm not sure I don't really mean it. I mean, I hate this world, this COVID world. I hate it. I hate this new world. And I don't particularly want to live in it much longer. It's bloody depressing. It's bloody miserable. So I was thinking about this as I was driving along to the next border post. And, you know, it's been going on a year and a half now. So if they wanted to say, no, we're closed, they could put up, they've got these, what do they call them, dot matrix indicators. I don't think I've really seen a lot of those since they invented the internet and computers and so forth. They've got these dot matrix ones that say, the border post I was trying to come through is closed to trucks between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. or whatever. They've got that sign. They haven't got a sign saying the whole bloody thing is closed to everyone. Even though it's been a year and a half now. So I tootle along to the one he told me to go to, and that's closed to. But this time I'm mad, so I want to pick an argument with some American twit who hasn't got his border post open. And instead, I get there, and the Americans have all got home. The only people there are Canadian, and the Canadians say, no, we're still open. If you want to drive into Canada, you can still drive your car into Canada. It's the Americans who shut up and go. So I can't even do my shoot me now routine with the American one. She says the only ones open are on the interstate. So I've got to go. Now I'm going, you know, I'm going an hour and a half out of my way. That's just that's the Canadian border. Why can't we all just say we're Haitians? Do you know, I don't feel there are enough Afghan translators. And I feel that from now on, whatever you are, you can be a United States citizen, you can be a Canadian citizen, just from now on, just say, no, I've renounced that. I'm now just an Afghan translator. I think that's actually a category separate, at least for the purposes of international travel, from mere Afghan citizenship. So I'm not saying I'm an Afghan citizen, but I am saying I'm an Afghan translator. If you want to make it more convincing, you can learn how to say bugger off in Pashto. When I put this to Lara Logan, and I should preface this by saying I have an awful lot of respect for Lara Logan. I think she is one of the most clear-sighted people on the Afghan situation, the realities of it, than almost anyone. But months before the Afghan thing, I think I was guest hosting for Tucker or one of the other show, whatever it was. And I was asking her about this different. Well, anyone can walk into America across the Rio Grande, but across the 49th parallel, there we can shut the border down. And I asked her why this was. And she said, well, there are different. Her answer was essentially that there are different political considerations. That shutting out Canadians, law-abiding Canadians who've got all the paperwork, that doesn't cause you political problems. Whereas, as we've just seen, having horse patrol guys, and this is the Rio Grande Valley, horse patrol guys whose horses have reins, and so the white guy on the horse is riding around a brown man is politically problematic. And so, George, when you say, are you on Bizarro World? Yes, you are. Because we've accepted the premise that even to raise the issue of objecting what's going on at the border will get you accused of racism. You don't have to do anything. You just have to be riding a horse in the normal way. You know, a horse is operated by reins. People in television studios don't get this, apparently. They think they've got, you know, that Tesla or somebody has invented the self-driving horse. And you don't need a method of control of the horse. So we live in an incredibly stupid time in which language is so corrupt. Now, the first people to succumb to corrupted language are politicians, which is why they're nervous, you know, and they're surrounded by staffers who are all telling, well, you know, a bit difficult to go anywhere near this and raise this issue. Do you know, the funny thing is, they use the idea of the strong man on the horse or the man on the white horse as a shorthand in Europe for the saviour politician. I think it predates the revolutions of 1848 in Europe. And the man on the white horse, the man on the... And then that fell slightly out of favour because the men on the white horse, as saviours of the nation, tended to be chaps like Mussolini and Hitler. But you know, Charles de Gaulle and the Fifth Republic, he was a conventional man on a white horse in many ways. And I was looking at that picture, the guy with the reins, and I was thinking, the left think of everything. They've actually made the man on the white horse a criminal offence. And to reprise what I said the other day, I wonder why, for example, when Biden is threatening to bring these men to account for riding horses with reins, why the Border Patrol officers en masse, I don't actually know why they don't just go and say, okay, we're on strike. He's insulted our men. They've got a union. He's insulted our men for no reason at all. He's implied they're guilty of criminal behaviour. They're going to be investigated. They're all going to lawyer up. Well, you know, we're just going to go on strike. And I know you don't care about that on the southern border because we're not allowed to enforce the southern border. But on the northern border, where there are 87-year-old snowbirds who are all getting ready to come down to their Florida condos, as they've been doing since 1937, we are going to walk away from all that and leave the northern border undefended. And then these guys would. But this is what it's going to take now. This is what it's going to take. And it's why looking to a self-employed writer is not the best way to do it. But it's going to take people who are in organizations to organize en masse and refuse to go along with things. And that's another thing I often say to Northern Border officials, CBP or whatever the stupid acronym is this week. I always say, wait a minute. If they're trying to ask me about something, I go, wait a minute. Because I got the impression, just from looking at all the people walking into the country and we're being told they're fine, upstanding, undocumented Americans, and as Nancy Pelosi says, they're better than we are. So I thought all the rules and regulations of customs and immigration, even public health things. Oh, yes, an American flying back into America, he's got to have his COVID test results and he's got to have all the other stuff. But if you just want to walk in across the Rio Grande and you're Haitian or you're an Afghan translator, that doesn't matter. So you're telling me, Mr. Border Officer, that certain parts of U.S. immigration law, apparently by mutual consensus, no longer apply. But the one little thing you're trying to nail me on, that little bit of the law still applies, does it? Aren't you ashamed of yourself for being a... And I do this whole thing. And as my darling daughter always says when she crosses with me, she goes, this is one day they're just going to shoot your dad. And then I'm going to be the person in the paper saying, oh, well, he died doing what he loved, yelling at federal bureaucrats. All you can do in the end, all you can do is do what you can do, which is to insist on living your life as a free person, even as Americans, you know, I mentioned Eamon de Valera's great line when he was trying to invent the idea of Irish citizenship in 1922. And him saying to a colleague somewhat ruefully that it was like all a bit of a waste of time. He said citizenship is basically a concept that doesn't exist in the British Empire. And at that time, he was certainly right about it. The Americans have always had an idea of citizenship. And what we're seeing now, you know, and this is where saying, oh, we're doing away with Kate Smith singing God Bless America ultimately winds up, the abolition of citizenship. That's why I say, if you don't want to surrender everything, surrender nothing. Because what is it like, say, to be a... I think it was Todd Lewis who wanted to know why I was going on about constitutionalism, why I was making a point of attacking constitutionalism. Well, I'll give it a go. What we have at the moment is a situation where the things that have an emotional tug on you as an American, and being an American is a legal status, but it's also an emotional status. And when you abolish the emotional status, I mentioned Columbus Day, Boston has just decided it's whatever it is, Indigenous People's Day or Indigenous Victims Day or whatever. Yeah, okay, well we'll chop away Columbus. That's statues all over the country. It's towns like Columbus, Ohio. It's songs about Columbia. It's Columbia as the original icon of America, more powerful an icon than Uncle Sam. You demolish all that, then you demolish Kate Smith singing God Bless America. Then you start teaching grade schoolers, kindergartners, critical race theory, teaching a four-year-old that he's the problem and his little white friends are the problem. And so you create a void. And the void isn't big enough to... The void can, and I'm not making an American point here. I've just come back from Canada where Justin Trudeau decreed that the flags are at permanent half-mast until the First Nations, the Indigenous persons, tell him it's okay to raise them up the flagpole again. Flags are at permanent half-mast. I don't even know what happens if somebody important dies. Like if Justin were to accidentally fall into a vat of kiwi polish and drown before his next event, what do you do when all the flags are already at half-mast? You lower them to quarter-mast? You have the thing just trailing along the ground? But it's a literal embodiment of how what's left after you've destroyed everyone, after you've destroyed Sir John A. Macdonald in Canada, after you've made it illegal to quote Winston Churchill in the United Kingdom, after you've banned coon cheese in Australia, after which is nothing to do with any people of colour, it's because the guy was called Coon who invented the cheese. After you do what you do in America, where these crap, awful corporate sports teams that the right, American right, still supports, even as they hate you and they're destroying you, and you take down Kate's... No, sir, we played Kate Smith here. Played Kate Smith singing God Bless America on September the 12th at Stein Online. Because unless you're willing to surrender everything, surrender nothing. And what happens when you do all the things that are emotional, that make you feel who you are? And that's not a constitution in most long-lasting societies. In most long-lasting societies, Sweden is just where the Swedes live, And the Netherlands is just where the Dutch live, and Slovenia is where the Slovenes live, and you are emotionally tied to... How can you be emotionally tied to a voice? Oh, I really, like, my dad had this Kate Smith LP when I was a kid, and we all loved... Oh, no, sorry, Kate Smith's been back. Well, okay, well, we used to read Dr. Seuss, but... Oh, no, those are the early Dr. Seuss books. They're all banned. Okay, well, I used to love going down to the park. They've got this fantastic statue of Robert E. Lee. You know that guy way down on the levee in old Alabama? Oh, no, you can't sing Waiting for the Robert E. Lee anyway. Okay. There's a void. And what incubates in the void? You know, if you're lucky, in that void, your kid will just be into the climate change bollocks. But if you're unlucky, in the void incubates a total loathing and hatred of the entire history of the country, in which now we see people just pouring across the Rio Grande, and somehow, because of our original sin, we are obliged to, as I put it the other day, you know, basically now America is manifest destiny for everybody but Americans. And it should be obvious nonsense. And the fact that it isn't obvious is why we have such a challenge ahead of us. Wait a minute. My computer's done a little thing, and it's done a hop and a skip on how the questions are coming up. Seth says, Mark, I respect how you are committed to the idea that language is important because it actually means something. That's not why it's important. It's important because language is used to control how you debate things. So in the end, the words affect the actions. You know, if you're wondering why, this is why that guy, what's he called, Frank Luntz, when his thing, doing his thing, words that work. What he means by words that work is he means words that squish Republicans can use without getting the vapors from their focus groups. And so what that means is that certain subjects literally can no longer be talked about because they can't figure out a way to talk about. For example, you know, immigrant, the word immigrant now generally means one of these Haitians wading across the Rio Grande, like literal Camp of the Saints. You can't say Camp of the Saints, even though that's a book that regardless of whether it's racist or hateful or anything else. It from 50 years ago, it's accurately predicted what's going on at Del Rio right now, which is pretty bloody good. You know, that's not bad for a guy to get it that dead on. And it's one reason to read the book, apart from the fact that it's actually an extremely well-written book. But you can't say that because the Southern Poverty Law Center, if a congressman says that, the Southern Poverty Law Center ensures that the GOP caucus kicks him out of caucus. Just like the word immigrant now, which used to mean people who filled in the paperwork and waited 10 years, now means someone who just wades across the Rio Grande. So language is important because if they keep chipping away at words, and this is why they're all trying to keep you on your toes, in the end you can't talk about anything. But Seth says, I have a question about the language used by almost all the economists and supposed smart people for the past 6 months. We were told this new inflation would be, quote, transitory inflation. I've never heard of inflation described this way until now, and wonder if it was focus group tested before people like Biden and Yellen started telling us about it. By now, I think we can see this was false and inflation is going to be painful and here to stay. How do you see it? And what word will be used next to tell us that hyperinflation or stagflation doesn't exist or isn't really a big deal? Yeah, transitory inflation is like the 2 weeks to flatten the curve. It's not actually brand new, Seth. In fact, I think Janet Yellen, or her predecessor at the Fed. We're not going back to Greenspan, but we are going back to a little ways after the Lehman Brothers business in 2008 and all that. Obama first term, and they came up with the term transitory inflation then. Now it's obviously one of these things like undocumented immigrant. You know, because for a start, what does it mean, transitory inflation? Does it mean that, oh, yeah, there's prices are going to go up and then they're going to come down again? Does it mean that prices are going to go up and then they'll stabilize at the high price? Or does it mean that prices are going to go up and then sort of carry on ticking upward, but at a much slower rate? If you were to ask, now, why don't if any of my friends in the American media are listening, in the Washington Press Corps, why don't you get someone in the Washington Press Corps to ask Joe Biden that the next time he's taking a question? Why not ask Jen Psaki that? The point is, the term is designed to obscure, and that's another way. You know, this is why the Canadian decision, for example, saying you've got to use people's preferred pronouns. So, for example, this person in this Canadian case wanted to be called they and them. She's a woman who's non-binary. She was born a woman, but she wants to be non-binary. So she wants to be addressed as they or them. So we've taken a word that applies to groups of people and said, no, it just now applies to an individual. And that's actually a big thing. That's actually a big thing. It's not like changing the word gay from, you know, what it used to mean to meaning a person of the homosexual persuasion. That's a small act of linguistic vandalism on a comparatively little used word. When you're doing it with something as basic as plural and singular, you've pulled off quite a linguistic heist there. And I think that's the other people occasionally complain about the words I use. They don't, you know, they think, oh, well, I had to go and look that word up. Well, good. I don't care. I mean, the idea that we're having an ever-shrinking vocabulary at the same time as we are transforming the meaning of basic words, as basic as singular and plural, means that I think anyone who can keep any other words in currency is doing the world a favor. Marshall Holstrom writes, founding member here, Mark. Congratulations, Marshall. We're glad to have had you with us all these years. What do you think of China's immediate future? I've seen everything from next hegemon to economic and or demographic collapse. Well, I said all this 15 bloody years ago in America alone. I use the line, China will get old before it gets rich. And people like that line so much. Henry Kissinger liked that line so much that he started using it himself in that fabulous gravelly voice of his. The one-child policy has been a disaster for China. That's one reason why, if you go to all these parts of the world now, West Africa and so on, you'll find tons of young Chinese men keeping active various Chinese government business interests in the resource sector all over the planet. And the young Chinese men get attracted to the lovely West African girls, or what have you, and because they are in a situation where there's no girls at home for them. I don't know what it's like when you bring those girls home, because the Chinese can be some of the most openly racist people on earth. That's actually, as we would now say. What they mean by that is they privilege their own kind above all others, which used to be how almost all societies operated. And when you've got over a billion Han Chinese, you can do that and function as a fairly conventional ethno-state. That's a huge advantage for them. So I don't think when you say the immediate future, there's not going to be any kind of demographic collapse in China. China is not a good long-term proposition, except in the sense that it has no rivals. When you say the next hegemon, what isn't hegemonic about China now? It's already had planes flying into Bagram. Bagram was quite a conveniently situated base, one would have thought, because it's near China. It's near Russia. It's near Iran. It would be quite a useful American base to have ears on the ground at what is, in a certain sense, the center of the world. You know, because London was the center of the world when they started doing maps of the Earth. London is in the center of the map with the Greenwich Meridian running down it. That's not actually how the world operates now. And Bagram Air Base can actually make a greater claim, in a certain sense, to be the center of where the action is. And in those places, China is already the hegemon. Now, we've just seen this whole thing where the Americans and the UK, I think there were Australian ships there, Royal Australian Navy, and they have what they call Big Lizzie, which is HMS Queen Elizabeth, leading the group through the carrier group through the South China Seas. And the Pentagon has sort of thrown this together to say, look, we're not losers. But actually, that doesn't really mean anything, does it? Doesn't really mean anything. And I think China is the hegemon right now. And China has set the terms on how the rest of the planet operates. So I don't think we're in for either immediate economic or demographic collapse. It's not a good long-term bet, but in the short term, it's on course to be the dominant global power. Peter McKinley writes, hi, Mark, when, not if, do you think China will be invading Taiwan? Should we have a Mark Stein Club water cooler poll or bet on the date? I was going to announce a competition for that. I was thinking we'd have two competitions, one for the Chinese annexation of Taiwan and the other for the date of the collapse of the US dollar. And if you want to chip in with your suggestions for that in the comments, we'll try and we'll hold them and then see if we can have a prize. But it's coming sooner. It's coming sooner rather than later. You know, the one country has vastly increased its power during the COVID 18 months, and that is China, no question. RB Neuberg says, I assume, well, no, it could be a miss or a Mr. or a Mrs. Whichever, I don't want to get, given that Canadian British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal decision, I don't want to get anything right with the honorific pre-nominal. I think I'll have to call him, her, they, Comrade Neuberg or Neuberg. Serious question. If the never-ending pandemic is so bad, is firing thousands of unvaccinated healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers the best way to treat patients for our health? Am I missing something? No, the people who were supposed not to be getting unvaccinated are supposedly all the Republican yahoos. Hee-haw, I'm not having anything with any of them. Nobody's sticking that government control thing into me. That's not going to be happening. So that is not what is happening. Instead, the people who know the most about it know the most about it are the ones who are not getting the have chosen not to get vaccinated. The vaccination, actually, what I find interesting, and I had a look into the studies on this, is the way the vaccination protection falls off so steeply. So if you seriously want it, this is something that, you know, if we lived in a less insane world, you would be able to discuss. Instead, if you were to put it in a tweet, Twitter would take it down and label it misinformation. But the way that the protection falls off very, very, very quickly, within four or five months. Now, these are medical professionals, and presumably they know that. So if they're not vaccinated, you know, it's not because they don't know anything about it. These are people who are there in the rooms, in the hospitals, with the patients. Because in the end now, it is, these things are all about, what is absent from the Western world is the idea that a citizen is allowed to be a calculator of his own risk. I don't think there's any real need for anybody under 40 to get the vaccine. As a general proposition, there is a need under 40 if you have some serious underlying condition such as diabetes or whatever, which may be a condition you don't think of as serious, but it is serious once something comes along. I don't think if you, even if you take all these vaccines at their word, that they made the case that anyone under 40 needs to get it. And you might be a woman who has difficulty getting pregnant and you still want to have another child and or whatever, and you've read these things, and you might have the fact that the information is being more restricted as well, the fact that Twitter and Facebook, basically, now we're living in a world, and just to go back to Comrade Neuberg's question, the reason why we're doing it this way is because we now live in a state of conformity. Conformity uber alles. That's what's of issue to everyone. Conformity uber alles. That's what matters. And that doesn't allow for any dissent on anything. So the important thing here is to comply. And if next week you're told to comply with something that's the complete opposite of everything, what you were told to comply with the previous week, that's just because in the end, the religion is the religion. It's the church of compliance. And that's actually a very, very... Now, why are we in a church of compliance? Why are the freest nations in the Western world right now, Scandinavia, which the average American thinks of as they think of these countries as socialist basket cases? Well, generally speaking, if you have small countries, so Norway is about 5 million people. I mentioned this in connection with Trump's thing as to why America didn't get more immigrants from non-bleephole countries like Norway. Well, there's only 5 million Norwegians, so if they all moved to America tomorrow, it wouldn't make a difference. It'd be a drop in the ocean, because you're going to have half that in illegal immigrants. At least you're going to have 2.5 to 3 million, and they're lying to us about all these numbers, but the numbers they've admitted to work out at about 2.5 million people coming across the Rio Grande and walking into the country just this year. So 2.5 million people is like 5 Wyomings or 5 Vermonts, according to Taste. And so the entire population of Norway, even if it moved to America tomorrow, would be a drop in the ocean. You wouldn't even notice it. Now, what it is, if you have small developed nations, relatively homogenous nations, which the Scandinavian countries were until Sweden decided to go bonkers on the Islamic immigration. But other than that, they're among the most ethnically homogenous nations on Earth. It's easier to agree, even in a big government, high social welfare, high tax society, it's easy to agree for, you know, as to what it is. Wait a minute, we got some phone beeping here? I don't even know what this is. Where's it beeping from? I'm trying to find the beeper. Where's the beeper? Where is this thing? Am I getting close? Fax machine. Can you believe that? Fax machine. Sorry about that. Where was I? What was I saying? Norway. Okay. Sorry about the fax machine. Send me a fax. What's the fax number here? I don't think I've seen a fax. The fax will be like, if they want to check whether I've had, you know, the 27th booster shot, you'll have to do that by faxing it to 1-800-CONFORMITY. Anyway, and never mind that. Sorry about that. My apologies for all that. The fax machine was hidden behind a box of audio cassettes. That's the kind of crackerjack operation we're operating. Norway. Yeah, Norway, 5 million people, ethnically homogenous, certainly by comparison with the United States or the British settler nations, or even with many other parts of Western Europe, as indeed Scandinavia is. And so you have a much higher degree of social trust and agreed social purpose, because everybody's the same. You don't have the kind of demographic imbalances you have in the United States, in some of these states where the very old people are all white and the very young people, as Kirsten Powers said when crowing over the result of the 2012 election, are brown. So you don't have a situation here where Jose and Ahmed are going to be the ones funding Social Security for Bud and Gaylord. So there's a higher degree of social trust in these small pop. That's why the place that big government works best is in small, ethnically developed, homogeneous states, such as those of Scandinavia. And one consequence of that, then, is that it's easier to take a decision as a country. And so, for example, Sweden's decision just to say, we don't think it's very Swedish to go into permanent lockdown. They've now been joined by Denmark in that, and they've now been joined by Norway in that. So if you go to Oslo, if you go to Copenhagen, if you go to Östersund, all these places are living the normal life they were living in February 2019. Now, to many people, many right-wing persons, that's not terribly appealing, because they're regarded as crazy left-wing countries. Bernie Sanders says he wants to be like Denmark. Well, Denmark, everyone's walking around living their lives as normal. It's impossible to do that, I think. If you've got a nation of 350 million people highly centralized, I think you can make the case now that India, for example, is a more genuine federation than a decentralized federation than the United States is, where you're having these national mandate. So I think that's one of the problems there. It's all about conformity. So they don't mind firing nurses for not being. They don't know what they're doing. I mean, this is like, so we're in a situation where on the public health. They don't know what they're doing on the health grounds, but they know what they're doing on the control grounds. And they are confident that it advances their agenda to circumscribe freedom. I'm not making a particularly anti-American point here, because I'll make the same point in anti-Canadian terms, where you can't get on a train, you can't get on a bus, and you can't get on a plane now if you're not, if you don't have your vaccine passport. So to go from Montreal to Toronto requires a vaccine passport now. This is the big difference between the real difference between now and the Spanish flu is, in the Spanish flu, we almost everyone was a genuinely small government nation. Even things that people think of as tyrannical states or semi-tyrannical, such as the Kaiser's Germany. The Kaiser didn't presume to regulate. It's quoted in After America. It's in Tocqueville. The idea that every aspect of life can now be regulated by the central government. And they're two experts. They're two experts. They don't know you. They don't really have any experience of how you of how you live and how you go about. They all marry each other. And they're all agreed that they are the experts and they know what is best for you. And that's why the example of those Scandinavian nations. Yeah, here we are, Eileen Robertson. Hi, Mark. Do you see that Canadian mammy singer is forbidding the unvaccinated to be on Canadian trains, buses, planes, or airplanes? How will this be enforceable? Oh, you can bet it'll be enforced, Eileen. It cannot be constitutional. Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? The British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal has just found the human right for a singular person to be addressed by a plural pronoun. They'll likely be able to, and all that's doing is saying it's the classic who whom thing of Lenin. You know, who whom, and which basically means who's on the receiving end. So if it comes to transgender pronouns, it's the transphobic restaurant owner who it's getting done to, and the trans is doing it to them. Likewise, in this case, it'll be the vaccinated doing it to the unvaccinated. Eric Peterson says, Mark, given our moronic, decaying, weak-kneed, decadent times, as a musician and music aficionado, apart perhaps from some of the stirring music that has accompanied Tales for Our Time installments, what music might you recommend to your listeners, members, to stir souls, stiffen spines, and try to gin up the grassroots moving that will be needed to fight for this country at local levels, while our betters sip drinks we've never heard of at restaurants where we wouldn't not be allowed to darken the doors? Well, the one I always used to go for is Stout Hearted Men, which is from the operetta The New Moon. If you've seen the film version, you will know that Jeanette MacDonald beseeches Nelson Eddy that he can't fight the entire French fleet. There's no way he can do that. But he decides to go out there, and as he's walking along, he sings, Jean Castex, give me 10 who are stout-hearted men who will fight for the right they adore. Sorry about that last note. It's been a while. Start me with 10 who are stout-hearted men, and I'll soon show you 10,000 more. Shoulder to shoulder and boulder to boulder. It's a magnificent, inspiring song. And we need something. And we need something like that, because that's what's got to happen. And if you look at it this way, that's why I had such a great time. I so enjoyed doing that debate in Toronto with Nigel Farage a couple of years ago, because it was a room full of Toronto liberals who hated us. And if you lay out the case, You can change minds if you get the chance to do it. And that is the thing. You start me with 10 who are stout-hearted men, and I'll soon show you 10,000 more. And right now we're starting. We got 10 stout-hearted men, but we can't actually. We're being prevented from preaching the message and getting it out there. And for some reason, because we live in an insane world where we've actually rewired huge amounts of at least English-speaking humanity to the point where things like logic are now labelled as hate crimes, it's actually much harder and harder for the 10 stout-hearted men to find 10,000 more. But it is absolutely. It's the only way this is going to change. It's the only way. There is no silent majority. People are silent because people are silent in large part because they understand that if they say certain things, it will cause them trouble. And they know this because their so-called rock-ribbed Republican elected politicians don't know. Now, I'll give you an example. I testified at the U.S. Senate at the invitation of Ted Cruz a couple of years ago. And normally when someone from a certain state testifies at the Senate, the senator from your state is there to meet you and guide you around and whatever. And my senator, Republican senator, was Kelly Ayotte, Republican senator, New Hampshire. And she wasn't there. I didn't know any of this. I was informed of it later. I wasn't expecting to see her. I had no desire to see her. I regard her as a bit of a bore, got no particular desire to have to fake interest in her. But I was told that, she hadn't been there to greet me at the upon arrival at the Senate because the staffers had warned her it's, I'm a bit controversial with all of that. So this is like my own. I don't expect to be met by Jean Shaheen, who's the Democrat senator, but my own senator, And this sort of thing goes on all the time. And again, one of the problems here, it gets to the size of nations. It's the name of a book. It's a very interesting book. You can't have a large, centralized first world nation. You just can't do it. You look, why doesn't Congress work? Because there's 350 million people. So you work out, well, I'll just take Vermont next door to the great state of New Hampshire. They have one congressman for 600,000 people. It wasn't like that when the Constitution was written. And if you'd said to them, you're only going to have one representative for 600,000 people. The first thing those founders would have said, well, that's not really representative government. Because only a few very important people, like donors, are going to be able to have the ear of the congressman. Somebody explained it very well in our comment section a couple of years back, and it's true. It's not true representative government and then you've got your senators. You've got Dianne Feinstein supposedly representing 40 million Californians. I mean, so basically, she's the queen of a very large country. And you're not going to. The whole thing just falls apart at a certain size unless it's very, very, very heavily decentralized and the central government does absolutely minimal things. And that's not what we have, and that's not the way they want it. Carl writes, Mark, kicking around, probably a bad idea on a way to push back on the left's critical race theory insanity. How about instead of the high road trying their game of claiming to be the victim? Something like Christian faith, which, by the way, was the driving force behind ending the Democrat Party's slavery, compels me to judge people as individuals and not as groups. So CRT is trampling on my rights as a Christian. You could try that, Carl, but they're probably just going to throw a lot of stuff in your path about all these, you know, like these 70 years of pedo priests they've been coming up with under that French investigation into the Catholic Church there. You know, you forget that. That's how they actually think of it. They don't think. This is a very, the left is super secular now, super secular. Kyrsten Sinema, when I was trying to remember who she was, and I saw in one biography, she's described as the first openly non-theist member of the United States Senate. Now, the operative word there is openly. We all know that all these people just pay lip service. And by the way, many faith-based institutions, Patrick Leahy plays lip service to the Catholic Church, and he goes and worships every Sunday at St. Michael's College in Burlington, Vermont, which is supposed to be a faith-based institution. There's not a lot of faith in these so-called faith-based institutions anymore. And that's actually what we need. I found the saddest part of Douglas Murray's book on the strange death of Europe and the saddest part of Michel Houellebecq's novel. They're both trying to do the same thing. You know, Welbeck's hero in Soumission, that book, is he's trying to recover his Catholic faith. He wants to recover it, and he can't bring himself to do it, to make the final step. He can't bring himself to believe. Once he's lost his faith, he can't bring himself to believe. I honestly think that that is really, it's going to take something like that. It has to take something that has a pull on your heart, which is, again, another reason why I don't think the constitutional thing is going anywhere. It has to be an emotional tug. If you have a secular population, and at the same time, you remove normal appeals to patriotism. If you make the flag and the anthem controversial, if you make Kate Smith singing God Bless America controversial, if you make essentially the agreed settlement of the Civil War controversial, you leave the void. Midwestern Tim says, Mark, you've been the Western civilization is dying guy for going on 20 years now. As you noted yesterday, by quoting Jesse Kelly on the same topic, you are no longer on the fringe of mainstream belief. Wait a minute. Hang on a minute there, Midwestern Tim. Back when I started, I'm not a fringe guy. I've never been a fringe guy. When I first started talking about Western civilization, I was invited by whoever you want to name, presidents, prime ministers, princes, fellow who's now king, actually, had a long private discussion with me. Not going to say where he's king of, because I don't want people to rise up and topple him from his throne. But I started with Bush and Cheney. Had me in to talk about all this stuff. Cheney, this is a paradigm shift, what's going on in Europe, isn't it? And which is the way these guys talk. And I'm saying, well, but it was also true of various prime ministers. I've been, you know, I'm not a fringe guy. I've been invited to talk about big things, Buckingham Palace, Rideau Hall, Yarralumla, lots of continental places, and even occasionally the Oval Office. What's happened now in that time is that things that were mainstream then have become fringe. I read America Alone, said Midwestern Tim, when it was first released, and agreed with you at the time that if we didn't start taking the demographic breakdown of the Western world seriously, we were doomed. But I didn't think it would come this quickly, i.e. before I hit 40. Now that the cruise ships are anchored just off the shores of the Rio Grande and the leftists are doing their bit to immanitize the Eschaton, I'm curious to hear if you think that it's time to split up the Union. I'm particularly curious to hear you place our current situation in a proper historical context, i.e. is it as bad as it was for Lincoln in 1861, the Fathers in 1775, etc.? If it is time to split the Union, what would it take to do so? Well, I think it's obviously worse than the two historical examples you give there, the Founding Fathers in 1775. You will know that I Having been born as one of Her Majesty's Canadian subjects, I'm always moved by that line that was excised from the final draft of the Declaration of Independence, that, quote, "we might have been a great and free people together," unquote. In other words, there was regret at what the severance, because they understood in a certain sense that they were ethnically British subjects, and that they were saying goodbye not to some foreign oppressor, but to their cousins. That their crime was to take English and Scottish Enlightenment, but basically to take English and Scottish ideas of liberty a little further than the metropolitan power was prepared to do. Now, there's been a lot of bollocks that's gotten in the way of that old nation of immigrants, proposition nation. But in the end, that's the reality. They were people kissing off their cousins, and that's a sad thing to have to do. And same thing for Lincoln in 1861. These were Americans against Americans. Which is why, after the Civil War, they were keen to honour the men who had fought on the Confederate side and recognise that as part of a great reconciliation, binding together these another set of warring cousins once more, they were prepared to put up these statues to Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis and all the rest of it. Obviously, it's worse now. Half the country hates the other half. And even if you might say, no, I don't do that. My liberal kids drive me nuts when they come around for Thanksgiving, but I don't hate them in the end. I still love them. You might say that, but the left regards the right as evil. And their institutions issue lists of how evil you are. And it's not just that you can't get anywhere near their institutions, but like this fellow who was bounced from giving a talk at MIT, one of those centres of excellence that we're told by the complacents that America still has. It's not going to be that excellent much longer if you won't let a guy give a talk about life on other planets because he disagrees with the diversity bollocks down on this planet, which is just what's happened. This is much worse than 1861, much worse than 1775. I'm in favour of splitting up the Union. Basically, as I said, because I don't think you can be a first world country of four. I don't think you can be, you know, someone was leaving comments a while back saying they were sick of having trivia from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which we do occasionally on the 100 Years Ago show. We do quite a lot, actually. Well, the interesting thing is the Austro-Hungarian Empire was the European empire that was multicultural in the heart of Europe. You know, the German Empire was for Germans. And the other empires were only multicultural in terms of their overseas possession. The British Empire at home was just for English, Scots, Irish, Welsh. And the Russian Empire was for Russians and then a little bit of Central Asia, which, as the name suggests, isn't in Europe. But the Austro-Hungarian Empire was multicultural. And it wasn't multicultural in the way, it was just multicultural because it had Austrians, it had Hungarians, it had Slovenes, and it had Bohemians. And yet that too did not. Now we are turned, if you have a nation of 400 million people that is undergoing rapid demographic transformation, you're going to die in a bloody and violent way because it's not going to be Yankees and Southerners. It's not going to be one group of British subjects over another British subjects. It's going to be people who have, there's no connecting glue. What is the connector? Oh, somehow all these people are going to become devotees. All these people are instinctively conservative. This is what even a smart guy like Charles Krauthammer used to say about Hispanics come to America and they go on welfare. And I'm not talking about everyone, but I'm talking about the fact that whatever conservative lives they may have lived wherever they came from, when they come here, they become part of the Democrat coalition. And that is the same. Now, is that because there's not enough Republican outreach? No, it's simply because when you have mass, the people who are coming here are like the people who come from Syria or wherever, Afghanistan, and they get to Greece, and Greece hasn't got big enough welfare. So they go through Greece, and they go through Serbia, and they go through Hungary, and they get to Germany or Scandinavia because they've got the best welfare programs. There are refugees trying to get from France to the United Kingdom because the United Kingdom has got bigger welfare programs. So the idea, oh, these people are just salt of the earth concern. That's not why they're coming to America. They're coming to America to get everything paid for. And yes, for every, you can find some success. Oh, this is the next class valedictorian. Or you can find someone, for every class valedictorian you find among these illegals, you'll find far more people hectoring Kyrsten Sinema on her plane or Kyrsten Sinema in her bathroom stall. So all these delusions. If you, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is worth studying. For a start, it's never a waste of time to learn stuff. But it's also sometimes relevant to your situation. There's no such thing. There's never been in human history a nation of 400 million that is broker than any nation in history, that has a military budget higher than close to what the rest of the planet has for a military budget alone, that nevertheless manages not to win any wars, that is indebted to its principal geostrategic rival, that has outsourced all its old type manufacturing, plus it's all its new computer stuff, to its principal geostrategic rival, and yet keeps importing tens of millions of people for cheap service jobs that have been rendered obsolete, not just by technology, but by the COVID. So everybody, everything, oh, I'd like to buy a cup of coffee. You're going to need an app for that. Because we don't want to have any human contact now because of whatever variant is next down the pike. So it's obviously worse than 1861 and 1775. And obviously there's no comparison between a small group of East Coast colonies and a continent-wide nation of 400 million people with open doors. I mentioned yesterday this. Everything else has changed in the last 20 years, except the number of illegal immigrants living here, which has stayed constant at 11 million. Everything else has changed. The proportion of Afghans who are accredited US translators has gone in that time from 0.5% to 87%. But the one fixed constant in an ever-changing world is this official number of illegal aliens living here of 11 million. It's stupid to die this stupidly, to commit suicide this stupidly. Now, I'm in favour of dissolving the union. I just wonder how you'd go about it, though. You know, there's an amusing map that's going around. They do these every few years. I think they did it in 2000, 2004. It's a map show of North America showing the United States of America and the United States of Canada, where somehow a divorce has been affected and Alberta... Manitoba and Saskatchewan have been prevailed upon to join the United States, and Canada has acquired the West Coast, the Pacific Northwest. So it's got California, Oregon, Washington, and it's got New England and some of the Mid-Atlantic states. And so the map's been redrawn, although it's all still pretty much contiguous. And I look at that map, and the first thing I saw on it was Pennsylvania remaining as part of the United States. And I thought Pennsylvania, the United States of America is in red, and the United States of Canada is in blue. And I wonder how much would be left if that divorce were affected, because Pennsylvania isn't going to be sticking with the red states under that scenario. The two most consequential states for Democrats when it comes to the Electoral College and the number of seats in the House of Representatives are California and New York. They're big seat tallies, big Electoral College vote tallies. You get that, boom, you're off to a great start. And they dominate those states overwhelmingly, as we just saw in the California recall. On the Republican side, it's Texas and Florida. Florida has been a swing state, as you know, for decades now. It goes back and forth, back and forth. If a Republican does not win Florida, the arithmetic is hellish. Then we have Texas, which is a fast purpling state. Where do you think the Democrats, when they let all these people into the country, where do you think they're sending them? And so that's the difficult question. You know, a lot of these blue states are deep blue, and a lot of these red states are rather purple. But if you could affect a breakup of the union in some sense, I don't even mind if it would. I wouldn't even mind if it would have break up into 50 states, and it would look like continental Europe, and it'd be a wonderful thing. You could drive in any direction, and within a couple of hours, you'd be in a new country, and they might have all kinds of new things that they do their own way. And you might have, as residual clingers to the original idea of America, you might in the end just have only a small number of states with a smaller number of people as Scandinavia. But that would be a wonderful thing, because I do believe, as again to go back to what I said in America Alone all those years ago about the European Union, that the ones who will have a fighting chance of survival will be the ones who split from the big centralized control of Brussels. And I said, united they'll fall, which I think was a chapter heading somewhere or other, but divided, some of them will have a sporting chance. And that is my conclusion about America today, that on this trajectory, united we'll fall. And if we were to if we were to split up, you know, I say this in Canada, if Quebec voted to secede, I might regret it, but it would have a bigger population than Norway, and there's no reason why it couldn't survive. And this idea that if you want to just, you know, the future otherwise is five judges on that ludicrous Supreme Court torturing the language of the Constitution to justify whatever perversion they're going to inflict on you next. So it's worth thinking about these things. I've gone a little long, as I tend to do on these shows, because I always get so many interesting questions. I hope you have a terrific Columbus Day. If the coppers come round and demand to know what you're celebrating, just tell them you're celebrating Canadian Thanksgiving instead. But I've had a terrific time being here, as I always do, and I thank you so much for your questions. And I do really apologize. For that terrible business with the beeping noise of the fax machine. I had no idea whoever installed that fax machine in my state-of-the-art radio studio, that's a firing offender. We don't want any. There's no one I want to get a fax from. Don't fax me about that if you belong to the big fax machine factory outside of Wuhan. It's been great fun being with you. I always like to leave you with a little bit of music. I saw that Mike Renzi died the other day. He was a terrific pianist. I saw him, I would lose count of the times I saw him over the years playing for, he was a great instrumentalist, but he also was every singer's favourite pianist because he was a terrific and sensitive accompanist, and I mean every singer up to and including Lady Gaga, who loved having Mike Renzi play for her when she does her standard songs. I think the very first person I saw him with was Mel Torme at, I think it was Michael's Pub in New York. I think this version is from a different club, but it might very well have been a night I was there. And they're singing one of my favorite Rodgers and Hart songs called I Like to Recognize the Tune. And if you are one of these people who hates jazz because these guys are just improvising all over the melody and you'd like to hear the melody, and so you wander into the little club and they're all goofing around on this thing for 10 minutes, and then a couple of bars sounds vaguely familiar and you go, wait a minute, this is Over the Rainbow? And you haven't heard. And that's the first two bars of the melody of Over the Rainbow you've heard. Then this song is just for you. Mel Torme, he name checks Mike Renzi at the piano here, because that's one thing he uses the song for. But the first two lines of the song are, I like to recognize the tune. I like to savvy what the band is playing. Savvy what the band is playing. That's one of my favorite Lawrence Hart lines. Unusually, Mel here, when he does the second chorus, he doesn't quite get it right. He repeats the rhyme, they whatever it is, they ruin the Billy Roses and Puccinis, don't be meanies. And in fact, I think for the second chorus, Larry Hart wrote, they kill the Richard Rodgers and the Glinkers, don't be stinkers. And obviously Glinker is only in there because he rhymes with stinker. But it's a terrific performance. I thank Mike Renzi, who died, too young for my taste, but he gave me so many pleasurable nights at one club or another, one concert hall or another, from Mel Torme to Lady Gaga. Maybe we'll play Lady Gaga next time. But in the meantime, here is Mike Renzi with Mel Torme. I like to recognize the tune. I like to savvy what the band is playing.
Some funny folks like to shoot off rockets. Others like to pick your pockets. Some of them keel when they feel the earth. Others go in for perjury. Well, I too have a passion which I can't understand. It comes out when I hear this band. I like to recognize the tune. I like to savvy what the band is playing. I keep saying, must you bury the tune? I gotta know the answer soon. Is it the cat meowing in the attic? Is it static? Must you bury the tune? A guy named Donnie plays the drums like thunder, but the melody is 6 feet under. There isn't anyone immune. They've killed the Billy Roses and Puccinis. Don't be meanies. Must you bury the tune? The melody, what the hell happened to the melody? When they start to improve on some good composer, I say, no, sir, I like to recognize a tune. Then Renzi starts to do his piano magic. That's tragic, must you bury the tune? Some nights I like to sing Blue Moon. Jay decides to play a little solo. Listen, that solo, must you bury the tune? A guy named Donnie plays the drums like thunder. Where's the melody? I start to wonder. There isn't anyone immune. They've killed the Richard Rodgers and Puccinis. Don't be meanies. Must you bury the tune? I'd give a million if I could hear one melody that's free and clear. Why must you bury the tune? Shadoobo, shadoodoodoo, shadoobadoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodoodo
the tune, the tune, the tune, the
This is Mark Stein. On this week's Song of the Week, we get a little lost in translation with a lovely song from continental Europe that we snuck in through the Irish backstop. But despite our best efforts, it nevertheless got mangled by Americans and Englishmen into multiple unsatisfactory Anglo versions. Bing Crosby and Gracie Fields and Charles Boyer will help me tell its story. Stein's Song of the Week, Sunday, 5:30 on 7-8 Radio.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.